Welcome to Health 101, a podcast by the Metro Omaha Medical Society. This season, we're focusing on the business of medicine. Physicians are trained in the art of caring for patients, but often there are gaps of learning when it comes to making business decisions. We hope this helps. Today, we're talking about clinical research and the place it has in the careers of physicians who aren't doing either pure research or are working in academic institutions. And today, we have two representatives from Quality Clinical Research. Brian Hollis, Doug Dunning. Dr. Hollis, why don't you start us off and tell me how you got to where you are, because you are the medical director.
Sure. Really, I started with COVID. And so there were a few doctors in the hospital that were conducting inpatient clinical trials. One was a pulmonologist and one was an infectious disease provider. They asked me to help out with some inpatient trials, and I agreed to do so. And this was right at the beginning of COVID, and you know, patients were kind of trickling along, and you know, those studies filled up fast. And then as time went on, you know, I spoke with Tricia, who's the owner of the company, and said, yeah, this seems like something I'd want to do and help out with. And so she presented me with additional protocols as they became available. And I selected one that thought would be a good fit and one that we could enroll patients with. And basically, I ended up taking over everything from an inpatient standpoint. And at that time, the IRBs and the accrediting boards, all this stuff, it was easier to go through things with COVID and it was an expedited process, and it made it easy to get started. And with this study that we did, we ended up being the leading enroller nationwide for an oral medication for COVID that ended up being found to be efficacious. And so it was rewarding, it was interesting, it was stimulating, it fit within my regular day-to-day flow. And then from there, I ended up incorporating myself into the outpatient realm and the clinic and doing studies with them on a day-to-day basis. And through the past 4 to 5 years, I've become much more involved. I became certified as a principal investigator and have, you know, continued to grow, I guess, a second sort of career as a clinical researcher.
And Dr. Dunning, you chose this pathway a little later in your career.
I did. I just retired earlier this year, and as I was looking toward retirement, I ran into a physician who'd been retired for over 10 years and asked him what he was doing, and he told me about what he was doing at Quality Clinical Research. He says it was one of the best jobs he ever had. So as I prepared to retire, I contacted Tricia and looked into it, and ended up becoming a part-time part of the organization. And it's been very rewarding, and it's good not to come to a sudden intellectual stop at the end of a long career. So it allows me to continue to be involved in the science of medicine and to continue to have contact with individuals, the subjects, and the studies.
Tell me about what Quality Clinical Research, and really the world of clinical trials, because I think that is largely what Quality Clinical Research does, to talk about what that entails from a physician standpoint and who that typically attracts. Are you using your own patients in your own clinical setting? Are you using patients who come because they want to be part of medical breakthroughs?
It can be multifaceted, and it can be both of what you described. So our model with Quality Clinical Research is we are a standalone research site. That means that none of us have our own patient panel to, you know, obtain the patients or that sort of thing. There are other organizations that embed themselves within an existing practice, and those folks use their providers to get the patients and utilize them that way. We have a database of, you know, 18,000 plus patients in the area that have participated or expressed interest in participating in the past, and that's where we get the majority of our participants. But we are 5 or 6, you know, retired, actively practicing physicians that all split the time within the clinic, and we see the subjects as they decide to participate in the various studies that we're conducting.
And what kind of studies have you been involved in so far? And is it mostly medicines?
It's been fascinating. There are a couple of vaccine studies going on right now. One of the really interesting ones to me is for years, I would test lipoprotein A levels in my patients because it's a bad cholesterol particle that's a huge risk factor for cardiovascular disease, but there was never anything we could do for that. One of the studies QCR is doing involves a new treatment for lipoprotein A. So primarily vaccinations and medications are what we see.
What does it take to be a physician who does this type of research? Either one of you, is it because you both do it on a part-time basis? You did not make this your full-time research career. So what is it you do and how do you balance that?
It for me, it involved a lot of training initially, learning about patient safety protocols, ethics protocols, and how studies are constructed and managed. And then with each individual study, you have to learn about the background of that disease state and medication. So it's been a great way to stay engaged in medicine.
Yeah, I think first off, what one really would need to have to participate in as a clinical research is the interest. You know, it has to be something that you want to do and want to participate in. And then from there, at least within our organization, there are a lot of different ways to frame how one could become involved with us. You could be like Doug or I, seeing participants. We've had other providers reach out to us that would like to make their own protocols, become involved with us and refer their own patients for studies that they would like to participate in. We've had device studies and surgical studies and all sorts of stuff in the past. And so there are a variety of ways for providers to become engaged or participate if that interest is there.
Is it hard? Is it hard to balance, though? Because you have a clinical career. You have patients. You have daily demands, and to add this on layer on top?
It can be. What is beneficial for me is it's sort of a step back and a different framework to view a patient and medicine. So I work in the hospital and I only see acutely ill patients. And so this gives me a chance to spend time with the patient in a different sort of manner, have continuity with them, which I would not generally have. And then just go through a process that's different through my normal day. So although it makes me busier, it does give me a chance to sort of refresh myself from other clinical activities and allow me to do something different and, I guess, keep my focus on both activities separately.
What stopped you from maybe doing this when you were working full-time, Doug?
You know, that's an interesting question, Carol. I never saw myself being involved in research. In fact, I used to say I'm glad there are other people that are interested in doing it because it didn't appeal to me. But and I think what kept me from it was the rigors of day-to-day clinical practice. And now that I'm retired, that part of my life has changed, and I have time to be engaged in this in a more leisurely manner on my own time. But it's fascinating and rewarding.
Who's not good for this type of thing? And is it also dependent on their contracts with their hospitals? And because some of those hospital systems do their own internal research.
Sure. And so, I mean, somebody that wouldn't be a good idea would be one that is an academic facility. They would be somebody that I'm sure their contractual obligations would now not allow them to participate with us. Now they would certainly have opportunities within their own institution. Realistically, the one like characteristic that I would think would make somebody not a good fit for clinical research is somebody that is impatient. It's a slow process. It can be slow moving at times. And sometimes it can be, you know, a challenge or frustrating waiting for new protocols, waiting for new studies, waiting for patients, because we're dependent on that. And it takes a little bit of time to get used to the process. And if you can do that and come around to it, it can be rewarding and it can be fun and it can be very interesting and satisfying professionally.
Doug, what have you learned from doing this as kind of the off-ramp of your career to off-ramp into this? Is this a good move for people who are starting to step back from their active practice career years and say, this is an opportunity? are there some cautionary tales or some warnings you would give them in thinking about it?
I think it is an excellent off-ramp, as you put it. You know, when you look at the many years of postgraduate education and decades of clinical experience, it's a shame to put that on the shelf. And so I would hope that I can bring something to the table in that regard. Some of these participants may not see a physician on a regular basis. And for them to have a more personal unhurried visit with a physician, I think it can be very good for them, not only in the study, but in terms of their own health care and their willingness to pursue that. But I think it's a great kind of an off-ramp. For me, you know, the little bit of extra added income is nice. You can leave the retirement fund on the shelf a little bit. But it might be a little uncertain as a sole source of income, because sometimes studies are busier and other times they aren't. So that's another consideration.
I'm also curious, because of where you are in your stage of life and where you are in your both your stages of life. So what happens when you want to take a vacation? What happens when you've got a study going on? You know, do you have pauses? Do you have as much make it up as you go along? Because some of those IRBs are pretty rigorous in terms of what they demand.
Yes, they can be. What we do as a clinic to allow sort of personal time and that sort of thing is, like I said, we have a number of investigators that if one of us is out of town, at a conference, on vacation, whatever it may be, or needs a day off, or I'm working a night shift, you know, there's other people to cover. Right. Now, what can happen is when you're a principal investigator, things come up with this protocol and or a subject and a participant. They may need a safety assessment, or something happens, or there's a question in regards to what to do. And then usually it's a text or a phone call to start off with, which usually is well enough managed. But we always have backup available in case I were not available, that they could reach out to Doug or they could reach out to one of our other providers. And usually that would be pre sort of planned if I was to be out of town or if one of the other principal investigators was out of town. And that way we are not having a lapse in coverage and ensuring the patient safety is 100% covered, but also would allow free time and family time or, you know, leisure time that is necessary for all of us.
Doug, you mentioned it's a good kind of little bit of money coming in. You said it's not necessarily good for a full-time income, but is it good enough that it takes care of your malpractice and your licensing and so those things and gives you a little bit, or does it, or is it one of those where don't lose your day job?
Well, you know, it's a nice little added source of income, and you can kind of let them know, you know, how much you want to work or how much you don't want to work. So I found that I can pick a comfortable amount.
Do you have to do a lot of research back into the topics as you start getting a project and you're onboarding? All of a sudden you say, I have not looked at that type of subject since I was in med school.
Well, for me, it's more so that I have not maybe been involved in it when I had a clinic in residency or immediately thereafter. As a hospital provider, there are things that I don't necessarily need to think about on a day-to-day basis, whereas I might with a research protocol or, you know, these sort of patients. For instance, we're doing a celiac study, which is not something that I generally would, you know, have in a hospitalized patient, or it wouldn't be the reason why they're hospitalized generally. And I had to go back and you know, review the science behind it and some of the underlying sort of conditions that can be associated or laboratory abnormalities in while reviewing the protocol. And so oftentimes there are things like that where I need to go back and sort of relearn those issues. And it helps me be a better provider, because when those issues come up either there or in my regular practice, then I'm more aware and can, you know, be fully participant in those as well.
Do you wish you had done a little bit of this when you were practicing? Because it almost seems like for Dr. Hollis, if it's that wonderful thing of, oh, I'm taking some of this information and I'm a better, you know, physician because my scope of knowledge is so much increased and my access to what's exactly happening in certain areas is increased, you know, I'm sure that you are at times doing something and you think, gosh, I remember this patient who had really tough problem. We had really tough time controlling this. I wish I had known a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a good way to stay up and stay current. And actually, in retrospect, I could see it would have been a good thing to do.
Anything you want to say about how it feels when you do something and you see it come to fruition and you see positive results and what it does for what you know you're doing for patients and healthcare going forward?
I mean, still going back for me, the best example I can provide is the COVID inpatient trial that we did that had a substantial reduction in mortality for the patients that received that medication. And so that was one, and coincidentally, it was the first real study that I participated in, that the results were proven. They matched kind of what we expected from what the patients kind of did, although we were blinded on the study. The nursing staff, they would come up to me and say, hey, Dr. Hollis, you know, I can't believe this patient is so much better. Like, I think that medicine is doing something. And I would tell them, I said, you know, we're blinded. We don't know if they're receiving a placebo. We don't know if they're receiving the real thing. But actually, like, after a few, you know, we had 27 patients enrolled, and after a number of people started improving when other subjects or other COVID patients that didn't participate were either not getting better or their progress was more gradual, kind of thought in my head, maybe this is doing something. And then the results substantiated that. And it really probably piqued my interest, and it was probably very beneficial for the start of my career doing this, that I saw something that really made a difference in patients' lives, and in this case, saved a few lives for the number of patients we had.
And for me, it's been fascinating to see the evolution of the immunizations. Looking back to when I started my career, we didn't have a Haemophilus influenza B immunization, and every year we had little ones in the ICU with that. Well, now that doesn't happen, and I've seen the evolution of the various pneumonia vaccines, and so now it's fascinating to be a small part of that evolution. I mentioned the lipoprotein earlier. When I saw that study, I was so excited. Gosh, here's something that I haven't been able to do anything about. And so it is. It's neat, it's fascinating, and it's rewarding.
Well, I am looking forward to more advancements to come thanks to the two of you. So thank you so much for being here today. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you so much for joining us. For more information and to listen to past episodes, please visit us at omahamedical.com and search for podcast.
A Huda Media Production.
The information shared in this podcast is for informational purposes only. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the presenters and do not represent the thoughts, advice, or opinions of the Metro Omaha Medical Society. The information contained in this podcast should not serve as the basis for any medical treatment and is not intended to be a substitute for actual medical advice. Before making changes to your healthcare plan or a loved one's, always consult with a healthcare professional.